Accession number 9434, Reel 10.
Mr. Bill Collins, Reel 10. You were telling me about the officers in your advanced aid post at Vermel. I wonder if you could continue.
Yes. I was talking in the trench one day to Captain Blood, and he told me, he says, you know, he says, here we are, he says, in the mud and snow and ice. He says, and I'm a tropical diseases specialist. He says, it sounds rather humorous, isn't it? And he says, I've applied to be sent into a different sector, and eventually they sent him to Mesopotamia, which was the place where he should be.
Now, in this aid post, could you describe a little more about what was in it? You had carbide lights. Did they need electricity? Or
No electricity, no. Just the carbide lamps. And candles, of course. By the way, a candle, in those days, in the trenches, a candle was like gold dust. A candle was currency for things of much greater value. We always the infantryman, the great joke was, have you got a candle, chum? He always used to ask the Royal Engineers and call people like ourselves and the Army Service Corps that he came into contact with, have you got a candle, chum? You know, later on, of course, in the Second World War, have you got any gum, chum? But with us, it was have you got a candle?
This was to use in the dugouts.
In the dugouts, yes. It was the only form of lighting, you see.
Now, so you had these carbide lights and occasionally candles to light. You just had the one crate. So would you lift the patient onto that crate?
Yes.
Was his stretcher, and then off after he'd been done?
Yes, we lifted him up onto the crate, and after the examination he'd be lifted down and another stretcher put in and taken out. We could only use one stretcher at a time, and taken out and the other one brought down.
Would you only have one patient in the actual dugout at a time,
then? That's right, yes. It wasn't a big cell. It was only big enough to take one with a couple of officers bending over him and stores of water in petrol tins and things like that.
So the others would be laid out in the open?
The others would be laid out in the open waiting, yes.
In a trench, presumably?
No, out in the open. The communication trench started about 30 yards above Vermel's. That's the way you went into the communication trench. But so we used to lay them under the out in the open.
What sort of things would they have at the aid post? Would it be pretty much as what you've already described, bandages and iodine and gauze?
Yes, it was a treatment designed to make them as comfortable and as safe as possible, because we used to get the ambulances, motor ambulances, right up to Mervell's, right up to the aid post. We used to get them right up. There was a good track between Newlymean and up to the aid post.
Had anything new come along in the means of treatment and medical care in the since the last time you'd been in the line? Any new developments?
No, I don't think so. It was iodine was still the specific, you know. Iodine was what we used on wounds. Iodine, gauze, bandage, wool and bandages. No, nothing new. It wasn't until 1917 that the Thomas splint was invented. Thomas splint.
Okay, we'll deal with that. I'll make a note and we'll come to that later then. So, what exactly now in this sort of new unit was your role? What exactly were your duties and your responsibilities?
Well, in the trenches themselves, I had two stretcher posts in Quarry Alley, which was one of the communication trenches leading up to the quarries, which is the front line, and two stretcher posts in Hullock Alley, which was the communication trench leading up to Hullock, you see. And the trenches at the top of Hullock Alley, the nearest trenches were Crown Trench and Alexandra Trench. They were trenches manned by the cavalry working as infantry, you see.
What was a stretcher post? What would be at a stretcher post?
Well, in the stretcher post, you see, they were cut into the side of the trench. They weren't dug out. They were cut into the side of the trench, roofed over, and long enough to hold stretchers. And we also had the anti-gas you know, the gas spray, which we try to use. And of course, in the communication trench, there was a gas gong. It was an empty shell case hung up, and a sort of stick there to hit it if gas came over. You could hear the gongs going all over the trenches. Gas alert. That was a gas alert.
How many stretchers would you have in each stretcher post, and how many bearers?
I'd have two stretchers in each post, and six bearers. Because, you see, in the trenches, you can only use two men on the stretcher. They weren't wide enough. You can only use one man at the front and one man at the back. You couldn't use one man at each corner like you would do out in the open, you see. You can only use... the trenches are so narrow. So, and the other man was the third man was a standby in case one of the bearers broke down or was wounded.
What sort of conditions? Where exactly would you be based when you were?
I was based in the Vermelles Hole, in that little hole in the ground in Vermelles, and every day I used to go three times a day round those posts, morning, afternoon, and night, every day visiting them, you know, see anything doing, and that's when I used to run into casualties. You see, I used to run into the casualties being brought down, so I kept in touch with them all the time, you see.
So you were checking that everything was all right?
Every day, three times a day, in the daylight. It was quite unsafe. It was an unsafe thing to do because the German artillery was so good that they used to drop the shells right into the trenches. Not there or there, but right in. One day I took Sergeant Mackenzie, a little Scotch chemist who was joined the army and joined us. I took him up to give him his first introduction to the line, the firing line. And we hadn't got 40 yards into the trenches when over our heads I heard the whiz down. I said, "Mac, flatten." We flattened ourselves on the bottom, and these whiz bangs, the 77mm whiz bangs, burst right over our heads. And I actually picked up the nose cone of the shell 2 yards away. I picked it up and dropped it. It was red hot. That was out there. They were right on top of us. Fortunately, we got away with it because we got down quickly, you see. But it was if you showed a whisker in those trenches, you were either sniped or shelled. In those communication trenches, right from the time you got in to the time you got up to the line, if you showed yourself in any way, they would swish those whistbangs at you. In the distance was one of these big coal tips, and they could see right down into the trench. They overlooked the whole of the position. Look right down into the trenches.
I presume you were very conscious of this need for care then.
Oh, I was. I was most conscious. I was most conscious. I used to. If we happened to be repairing the side of a trench one day, and the chaps were tossing some earth from the bottom of the trench up onto the berm. You know what the berm is, don't you?
No.
The berm of a trench is when the wall of a trench goes up, and then there's a little flat section, and then the parapet. You see, well, that flat section is called the berm, B-E-R-M. Well, they were tossing turd over the berm, and the German machine guns were so accurate, they were putting their bullets right into the dirt as they tossed it up. So I had to stop them, because if I hadn't stopped them, the shells would have come over. And you see, you only win wars by conserving men. You don't win wars by getting casualties.
So, besides your three visits, inspection and checking visits, what else? What were your responsibilities and duties?
Well, my responsibilities were to see that the men were there doing their jobs, and to be there if necessary myself. And carry out the bandaging. I used to do a lot of the bandaging in the trenches myself. You see,
before
I went back to the cellar. Now one day I just got into the trench, and I heard an explosion up ahead. And when I got to a railway ran across the top of the trench, and it was boarded in, and into the wall under the railway was cut a little place. Where a man could sit down, you know, a sort of earth bench, a man, and the medical officer used to use that for his morning sick parades, you see. And there were about 14 men lined up in the trench past this railway thing. But when I got to the hole in the side of the trench, there was the medical officer, badly, very badly wounded indeed. They dropped a shell right in it as he was in the trench, as he was holding his sick parade, and they'd taken a huge slice out of his backside. He's badly wounded in the arm with the nerve severed at the elbow, wounded in the chest, and very badly shaken. And he was on his feet, dazed, I could see that, dazed, wondering, but I happened to walk straight into him. I was there seconds after he'd been hit. And he looked at me, and I said, "All right, don't worry, sir." I said, "I bandaged him, got all my haversack. Never went about anywhere without my surgical haversack on my back. I was always ready to deal with casualties. So I bandaged his backside, bandaged his elbow, bandaged his chest, put his arm in a sling, and then got a stretcher party up from the front, put him on it, and took him down." And then I went to the men who were on parade, the 14 of them, none of whom were hit. They were all right. They were clear, you see. But they'd been moving about the trench much too much and probably exposing themselves, and that's why the shell came over. So I told them, I said, "Look, who's the senior soldier here?" I always dealt with the senior soldier. "Who's the senior soldier?" And one fellow came and said, "I am." So I said, "Look, you go back to your officer, tell him your medical officer is very badly wounded. You won't see him again for years, if you ever see him again, and to apply for a replacement as soon as possible. Tell him that's a message from me. My name is Sergeant W.J. Collins, and I've treated him and taken him down to the medical officer in the cellar at Vermel's. All right, sir, take them. All right, Sergeant, it's our team." So I got rid of them, but none of them ever saw him because the Germans had got him first. See, that was the trouble. If you expose yourself that much over the top. Now, one day, I was walking up that trench, and I looked over the top to see what Graham Gay was like. It was a bright, sunny day. It was much farther up the trench than where I had managed the doctor, much farther up, close to the quarries. And I looked over the top quickly, but down. Then I had another look, and I was a bit longer look. And then as I put my head down, the sniper, he fired, and he just missed me. He couldn't have missed me by more than about 6 inches, because I looked at turned at the sandbags at the side of the trench, were split open, and the earth was dropping out where the bullet had gone into the sandbags. Now, that's how dangerous the communication trenches were up in Quarrielli, the Quarrielli communication trench was. Very nasty.
It also, it's an example of, even though you were aware of the dangers of showing yourself, how you could forget yourself for a moment.
Absolutely.
Would that be true?
Yeah, absolutely. Forget yourself. You see, I was keen to see what the condition of the going was like outside. And I just did it just once too often. If you did it quickly and put down, you'd be all right. But if you were up there for about 4 seconds, he'd be on to you. The sniper would be on to you. But you see, they had the most wonderful... one day, I spoke to a major general in the army, not many years ago, before he died. He was the father of a very, very old friend, dear friend of mine. And I said, "General," I said, "tell me," I said, "my experience of the German artillery and the German snipers was that they are absolutely superb." I said, they could put their shells and their bullets just where they wanted them. He says, "Yes," he says, "it was the sights. They had the wonderful Zeiss." You know what the word Zeiss is? Zeiss, Zeiss sights. Wonderful guys' eyesights. He says they were the best in the world. That's what enabled them to be so accurate with their artillery and their sniping rifles.
So on your daily duty, you were there to be wherever was necessary checking things. Would that mean if there are a lot of casualties, you'd go to that particular stretcher post?
Yes. One day in January, the 27th of January, which, by the way, is the Kaiser's birthday. And 3 days before the Kaiser's birthday, I read in the paper that his birthday was on January the 27th. And 3 days before, I saw Major Howie, and I said, "The Kaiser's birthday's on the 27th, sir." I said, "Don't you think that they're sure to make a demonstration of some sort, because, you know, they were very, this was early 1916, and the Germans were still on top. And I said, don't you think they might make a demonstration? I said, because I think so. And he said, yes, he said, it's possible. I said, well, I suggest that we double the strength of the stretcher bearers in each of the posts. And we got extra ones down from the reserve in Noeulimeen, doubled the strength in the stretcher bearer posts, and sure enough, on the January the 27th, they shelled the front line and our lines there very, very heavily. Gave them a nasty bit of, not long, but short and heavy, just to celebrate the Kaiser's birthday. Of course, they were casualties. We were dealing with them, you know, dealing with them in the usual way. And one of the medical officers in the line there was, I noticed, was Captain Price, Captain J.H. Price. He was the officer commanding the number 9 Cavalry Field Ambulance, but then some of the 9th Brigade were in the trenches there, you see. And he was there. I knew he was there. And one day, I was in the trench, and the shell had just fallen up ahead, not very far away, and two fellows came down with another one, and they said he was wounded, you see. And I said, well, where's he wounded? You can't see any wounds. They said, no, his officer has just threatened to put him on a charge for malingering. So I said, well, let's have a look at him. And I had a look at his eyes. Now, I always used to look in the eyes of a wounded man, soldier, because the eyes of a man will tell you what sort of condition he's in. And I looked at this fellow's eyes, and to my horror, the loose skin above the top eyelid, the upper eyelid, was pulsing. Pulsing, in and out, pulsing. And I looked at it and looked at him, and I said to the fellows, now make sure he doesn't go down, hold him, give him some support, and I sent an urgent message for Captain Price. Would he come? And he came. I looked at him, and he said, put him on a stretcher and send him down immediately. Now, this is the fellow who was going to be put on the charge for malingering. Now, I said to Captain Price, what is the correct description of his condition, sir? I said, I'd like to know, because if I ever see it again, I should know what to do. He said, well, he says, it's surgical emphysema. You know how to spell that? Surgical emphysema. And he says, what happened is, when he was blown against the side of the trench, a rib was fractured, and one end of the rib has punctured the diaphragm. And he is literally blowing himself up like a football all over his body. So for a man to be threatened with malingering in that condition was a bit tough, I always thought. But then, of course, the officer wasn't to know, and he probably didn't look at the eyes, you see. If he'd looked at his eyes, he would have seen. But I looked at them, and the moment I saw them, I rushed Captain Price to him. We took him down. And I said to him, will he live? He says, 50-50.
During this period, what were the most common sorts of wounds that you'd be facing in the trenches?
Oh, flesh wounds mostly. Arms, legs, shoulders, you know. Some head wounds. The head wounds, by the way, we hadn't got any, there were no tin hats then. No tin hats. And the tin hats didn't come until later in 1916. The Somme battle, they had tin hats for the Somme battle, but we had no tin hats in the Loos trenches, in the Vermelles trenches in the first three quarter of 1916. There were no tin hats at all.
So the wounds were widely spread.
Well, widely spread. There were head wounds of the third degree, which is the light, you know, the mildest ones. And I heard Captain Graham one day. He says we could save 33% of our casualties if there was a steel helmet. You see, this is because 33% of all casualties are head wounds of the third degree, which could be avoided with a steel helmet. And of course, it was true. There were so many head wounds, what I call mild, you know, from poor small pieces of shell or pieces of bomb, because you see, the Germans had the stick bombs, you see. And they had the rifle grenades. They had rifle grenades, and they had the what we used to call the toffee apples, which is an enormous thing that used to come rolling over and over and over and burst like a big shell.
That was a mortar, the toffee apple.
That was a mortar, yes. Well, now, that was the 27th of January. Now, on the 30th, came a day which I shall remember as long as I'm alive. Almost my last breath, I shall remember this brave fellow, unfortunate fellow. I was walking up Hullock Alley, and I came across a stretcher party of the 9th Division, the Highland Regiments, you see. And I saw them carrying a man on a stretcher. There were four of them, carrying him low. And I stopped them. I said, "What is there anything I can do?" And they looked at me. He said, "Well, have a look at him." I looked at him, and he was very badly wounded. He got, he was pockmarked on his chest. I just looked at his chest. So I said, "Well, come down to our aid post, because we're the nearest point here. It was not far off the bottom of the communication trench." And so I took him down to our hole in the ground at Vermels. And we put him on the crate. And I think it was Captain Graham who leaned over him and looked at him. He took his jacket off, you see, and stripped him down. And he got multiple wounds. He was literally pepper pot. And he gave a little sigh and died. And then Captain Graham looked at him and he said, "Well," he says, "there's nothing we can do." He says, you go through his... He said to me, "You go through his pockets." And he told the chaps from the Highland Regiments, it was the Royal Scots Fusiliers, the Royal Scots, not Scots Fusiliers, the Royal Scots. And he said, "You go through his pockets." He says, we'll go through and send what he has, we'll send them home to his next of kin. It's sure to be a letter in his pockets." And they said, "Tell your officer that we're going to send his little things home to his bed again." And so he gave me the job of going through his pockets. And I took out a document in an envelope. By the way, I looked at his chest and I saw the ribbon there. I said, "What's the ribbon?" I said, "That's the Victoria Cross, sir." And Captain Graham looked. He says, "Yes." He says, "So it is." I says, "This is a VC. I took his documents out, and he was Private Robert Dunsire, 1st Battalion Royal Scots, VC, 1st Battalion Royal Scots. And I took his papers out of his pockets. There was a letter from home, so I got his address. And in his pockets was an envelope with a document telling him he'd been promoted to Lance Corporal, and in the envelope was the Lance Corporal's stripes. He'd never had a time to put it on his sleeve. That was the most tragic thing to me. Did he die as a private, or did he die a Lance Corporal? In the records, VC records, he's down as a private. But in my opinion, he died a Lance Corporal. Because once he's been promoted, he's promoted. The fact that he hadn't got his Lance Corporal stripe up is irrelevant. He's a Lance Corporal. And I sent his things home to his next of kin in Glasgow.
Would you always take an interest in that way, in the people who died in your care? Would you always send their things on to them?
Oh, yes. If they died in our care, always. Yes, always. If I didn't do it, one of my chaps would. We always do that. But, you see, 99 times out of 100, they weren't with us long enough for that. We were treating them and rushing them down. The people who would do that would be down at the casualty clearing station. The hospital.
What would happen to the people who were dead? Would they pass through you anyway?
Yes, they were taken outside onto the field at the back of Vermels and buried there.
When your men, your stretcher bearers, would carry the dead out,
yeah,
in the same way as they carry a casualty out.
Yeah, yeah.
But who would check to make sure they're dead? Because it's sometimes
quite... medical officers. No man was ever carried out for burial unless the medical officer certified him as dead. See, there were always two medical officers there, always.
What checks would they use to ensure someone was dead? Because there's some controversy at the moment when you're dead.
They used to pull back the pupils of the eyes and, of course, take the pulses if there was no pulse. I mean, a dead man, there's no pulse. You see, you can put your finger on the pulse and there's no pulse. You see, but I wouldn't like to certify that a man's dead. I wouldn't like to say that I could say a man's dead. I think it takes a doctor to do that.
There were no mistakes made that you can...
None that I... No, no. No. You see, in any case, the man wasn't buried immediately. He was probably out there for a day before we could bury him.
Now, one of the jokes or saying amongst some infantry was that the RAMC stood for Rob All My Comrades, and they had other nicknames. What did you know about that sort of joke or saying, and how did you react to it if you did?
Yeah, I knew about it. We all knew about it, but I must tell you that it ran off my back like duck, like water off a duck's, because after all said and done, 99 soldiers out of 100 hadn't got sixpence to bless himself with. I mean, there were no valuables on infantrymen. Officers, nobody would carry valuables or anything worth carrying into the line, you see. The only thing was possibly an officer might wear a ring, a signet ring or something, but I never heard of a man carrying anything valuable into the firing line. At least they never had it. How could they do it on a shilling a day? See, that's it. No, it never worried me, and I don't think it worried anybody else. I know it was a joke. Robert Graves, he made play of it in his book Goodbye to All That. But you know, it's very easy to say that, very easy. When you remember our casualties in the war were very heavy, you know, they were extremely heavy, and as far as medical officers were concerned, they were killed so fast that they couldn't train them fast enough to replace them.
So you feel that you were popular with the troops you served, the cavalry in the line?
Oh, absolutely. The Sergeant Major of the Queen's Bays never let me pass his dugout without coming. Come in and have a drink. I always used to get on very well with the regiments that were in the 1st Cavalry Brigade. I knew them all. I used to make myself familiar with all of the officers. I knew that the commander of the 2nd Dragoon Guards, the Queen's Bays, was Colonel Lawson. I knew that the 5th Dragoon Guards were commanded by Colonel Harwood. And I knew that the 11th Hussars were commanded by Colonel Anderson. I used to make myself familiar with every aspect of the brigade. And, of course, Captain Rex Osborne, who was the brigade major of the 1st Cavalry Brigade, that was my brigade, I used to see him frequently. And you see, that's why he entrusted me with that message. He knew it would be delivered.
What condition were the trenches in this area?
Well, when we first went there just after Christmas in 1915, just before the new year, we went into these Vermels trenches, and they were muddy and sloshy. But the cavalry people soon got busy there, and I suppose they had the REs up and the Pioneer Battalion, because one morning when I went up, I noticed that the trenches had been cleaned at the bottom and duckboards fitted right the way up to up to the front line almost. So that made the, of course, stretcher bearing much easier.